What's up, Wildside besties and baddies? I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chelsea, and we're here to walk you through the wild sides.
From homicides to hosticides and everything in between.
We're so glad you're here, so buckle up
and enjoy the ride. So I'm excited about all the stuff we got going.
Oh, me too. Me too. There's been a lot of pokers in the fire, which is cool.
Yeah, and so just an update for you guys. I have been in communication with Carl Drew at the Massachusetts State Prison. We are ironing out a plan on how we're going to communicate. It's much more complicated than I initially thought. You have to be on phone call lists, and he only gets to update that every so often. He only gets a set amount of people that he can have on his phone call lists. And I've connected with Mike Campino, who is just kind of like he's a Massachusetts. He grew up in that area, and he's just a civilian who's taken on the case because he grew up with it. And so Wildside is going to pair or join forces with Mike, and he's got crime scene photos. He's got all of the court records. He has everything, and he's told me things that I had no idea that I've never read. And so we are going to start a side podcast that's an episodic podcast. And so Chelsea and I are really excited about that. You guys shoot us recommendations on what we should call it. I was thinking about just calling it the Scapegoat or Scapegoat.
Ooh, that would be fun. Yeah.
Or like the Fall River 3 or something like that.
The Fall River 3, yeah, something like that. That would be really cool. So I pretty much was like, I will make a trip up to Massachusetts if we need to and kind of sit down with some people. So like I said, we have a lot of really cool stuff in the mix. And I personally am really excited about this idea of bringing light to somebody who could very easily be falsely accused.
Yeah, I'm here for it. So we're working on that. We'll keep you guys updated as we progress through it.
Yes. In other news, I wanted to kind of tell, since we are in the true crime genre, obviously, I did want to tell listeners that there will be a what they are calling True Crime Fest Northwest up in the Portland area. So it is a 3-day gathering over Labor Day weekend up in the Portland area. And it is going to, they are saying, bring true crime fans together with authors, artists, podcasts, and advocates
ooh,
for victims. I know. And they're also, some of those advocates are also, it says, including people currently missing in the Pacific Northwest. So essentially like information, people who have information on currently missing people in the Pacific Northwest. And so anywho, you can hop online and check out, like I said, True Crime Fest Northwest. If anybody is in the Portland area over Labor Day weekend, or if you're one of those people who were like, that would be super cool to attend. I would love to attend something like that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can arrange that.
I know. I would really love to.
Because we're not going to be able to make Crime Con this year, but maybe next year we'll be able to do that.
I know. Yeah, we have Crime Con kind of in the works. So, yeah, I just wanted to bring that up. And have you had any updates on any news, crime news this week?
Yeah, so I'm sure this is old news for a lot of people, but I just found out that they think that they potentially identified the Zodiac Killer.
Really? How did they crack that?
So I think it was, it started with a group called the Case Breakers, and they feel like they have identified this gentleman named Gary Francis Post, and he was in the Air Force. He was an Air Force veteran, but he died in 2018. And so unfortunately, they won't be able to interview him or anything like that, but there's several articles talking about how I think they found his partial DNA. And the FBI was involved, and they've been kind of narrowing in on this guy for what sounds like several years, but they just didn't release it until recently.
Huh.
So stay tuned. If I find out more information, I'll let you guys know.
Yeah, man, the Zodiac Killer, it really is. It's mind-blowing to me that some of these killers can get by with murder for so long. Like how they can elude the cops, how they can elude DNA. It really is amazing. So I'm always thankful, especially for the victims, when they can bring some closure.
Yeah. And speaking of DNA, This is Forensics Week here at Wildside Podcast.
Oh, that's right. You know, the good thing about me is, unfortunately, I do have a little bit of that Dory from Finding Nemo syndrome. And I kind of get my weeks mixed up on what's coming up. And I totally forgot that this was DNA week and that this also means, does that mean that this is Dr. K?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh,
Dr. K's interview this week.
It's really, I don't think I can pick a favorite that we've interviewed with, but man, Dr. K is, he is really up there as far as the people we've interviewed.
Yeah, he's awesome. And so just a little bit of insight for the interview that's going to drop on Friday after this case. He is a, what, Chelsea, what is his, what does he do? He's a
professor of psychology.
I know, but he specializes in what kind of psychology?
Oh, forensic confirmation bias. So he is broadly interested in the psychology, causes, and consequences of wrongful convictions in the criminal legal system, with a particular focus on forensic science errors.
Yeah, so all of that to say, he's a psychologist that researches how accurate forensics is.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear in this interview, and it will probably bust you guys' bubble like it did ours, but forensic science isn't as sciencey as we think it is. And so that's what he studies. So today is going to be the corresponding case with Dr. K's interview. And so today we are going to be talking about the double homicide of Cheryl Williams and Carol Burice.
Okay.
We are back down in Florida where this wild case begins. In a small housing community located in Altamonte Springs, Florida, was a home at the end of a dead-end road. This house was home to three generations of women. The matriarch of the family was a 68-year-old woman named Carol Burice, her 47-year-old daughter, Cheryl Williams, and Cheryl's daughter, so Carol's granddaughter, Samantha Williams, who is in her mid-20s. So all three generations lived in this house. Grandma Carol had previously suffered a stroke, which left her partially paralyzed and wheelchair-bound. So her daughter Cheryl, Mama Cheryl, was by all accounts her primary caregiver. On the night of June 16th, 2004, Samantha, the granddaughter, she left the house to go stay with her boyfriend Mark Van Sant, which she often did. The next morning, Mark made his way to the home of Cheryl, Carol, and Samantha to pick up some clothes for his girlfriend, Samantha, right? So he was hanging out at their house till late that night. She decided she wanted to go stay with him at his house. She forgot to take her work clothes with her. And so in the morning, he goes back to pick them up.
Okay.
So when Mark arrived to the house, he tried to open the front door, but it was blocked. When he pushed it open a little further, he saw blood all over the floor, along with Cheryl's body.
Oh, gosh.
Mark immediately closed the door, believing that Cheryl may have fallen. He opened the door again and squeezed into the house. He could not fully open the door again because her body was blocking it. And so Mark immediately calls 911.
Uh-huh.
The operator instructed him to try to resuscitate her. And upon touching Mama Cheryl, he noticed that she was cold.
Mm-hmm.
When he checked the body, he stepped in blood. And he did not do anything further because the 911 operator instructed him to leave the residence.
Okay.
Within minutes, the house was swarming with police officers and crime scene techs. Deputy Pinsa of the Seminole County Sheriff's Department was the first officer to arrive on scene. Deputy Pinsa forcibly entered through the back door, and he was followed by officers Bates and Miller. Officer Pinsa and Bates were immediately attacked by the smell of iron as soon as they walked into the house.
Iron as in blood iron?
Yeah.
Ooh.
The scene was like something out of a horror movie. It was an absolute bloodbath. There was blood all over the house, all over the walls, all over the floors. They first found Cheryl, who was on the ground blocking the front door, as we said. And as it would turn out, Mama Cheryl had received the most brutal of the attacks. She had been stabbed 129 times by a large knife.
Gosh, 129 times.
Yep.
Have you ever tried to repeatedly like chop wood or something that many times in a row?
It's exhausting.
It is. I am always blown away when I hear that somebody was stabbed that many times, because I can do a repetitive motion, you know, like 20 times and I'm like, oh gosh, we got to take a breather.
Mm-hmm. She had stab wounds to her arms, legs, back, hands, feet, and chest. It would be identified that one of the stab wounds on her legs severed her femoral artery, and one stab wound to her left lung was considered the fatal wound.
Oh, gosh.
On top of being stabbed literally all over her body, she also had numerous defensive wounds on her hands and feet, which suggested that Mama Cheryl had had an extremely violent struggle with her attacker and put up a hell of a fight.
So Cheryl was the daughter of Carol.
Yes,
right? She was Carol's the grandmother. Cheryl's the mom, if you will. And then Samantha's the daughter, right?
Yeah, so I'll refer to Carol as Grandma Carol and Cheryl as Mama Cheryl.
And Carol was in the at the front door. She was blocking the front door. That's where Cheryl?
Cheryl
was at the front door.
Yeah, Mama Cheryl was at the front door.
Okay.
And this is who we're talking about. She's the one who had been stabbed 129 times.
Okay.
Crime scene analysts would go on to find Grandma Carol's body face down on the ground next to her wheelchair in the living room.
Oh, no.
Grandma Carol, though still mercilessly killed, suffered much less brutality than her daughter. Grandma Carol had been stabbed twice, once in the back and once in the chest.
Mm.
They believed that the fatal stab would be the stab wound to her chest, and it severed her left ventricle.
Mm-hmm.
Realizing that both women had been stabbed to death, investigators began to search the crime scene in and around the house to potentially find whatever evidence they could, along with the murder weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So while searching the crime scene, police happen upon what appears to be the most likely and obvious murder weapon, which was a 10-inch kitchen knife.
Okay.
They found this knife in the alley between their family's home and a neighbor's house. So it was outside of the house, just kind of in the middle between the space between the two houses.
Mm-hmm.
So they bagged it as evidence and continued processing the crime scene. Not long after the police had arrived and were processing the crime scene, Samantha, who is the granddaughter and daughter, she arrived to the residence.
Oh,
so Mark had given her a call and he had the awful time of breaking the news to her that her grandmother and mother were killed in the house. So when she got to the property, police quickly began to ask Samantha as many questions as they could to piece together what happened to Grandma Carol and Mama Cheryl.
What do you think of when you think of somebody being stabbed?
I don't know. Murder?
I think of the musical Chicago. And he ran into my knife. He ran into my knife 5 times.
Nope, that's never crossed my mind, not once.
Never?
No.
Do you know what song I'm talking about, though?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
But I've just never thought of that.
Mm.
So when they're questioning Samantha, obviously the first question they're going to ask is, where were you the night of the murders? Samantha shared that Mark had been over at the residence until late that night, as I had said, and she decided she'd spend the night with him. So around 10:30 that night, they left to go to his place. She noted that when she and Mark left, Grandma Carol and Mama Cheryl were both alive and well. Investigators would be able to corroborate this with Mark to verify that Samantha had an alibi and she was removed as a suspect in the horrific double homicide of Grandma Carol and Mama Cheryl. When they asked her if she knew of anyone who would want to hurt them, Samantha gave them a name immediately, Clemente Arguera Harkin. And I'm just going to refer to him as Harkin, okay? Harkin was the women's next-door neighbor, where he lived with two roommates. He was a 24-year-old man who had immigrated from Honduras and worked in a local restaurant. So when Samantha gave officers their name, this man's name, they were like, why do you think he's involved? And she said she just had a gut feeling about him. She had shared that Harkin often came over to the residence. They were cordial. They had gone to barbecue several times together in the neighborhood. Normal neighborly things.
Uh-huh.
But a few months earlier, Samantha said that Harkin had been banned from the house because Samantha woke up one night in the middle of the night and said that she found Harkin hovering over her bed.
What?
Yep. And can we talk about how fucking terrifying that would be to wake up in the middle of the night and some person is standing over you?
Yes, we can definitely talk about that.
Yeah.
One time I got up to go work. I couldn't go to sleep. It was just recently. And I went to go work. I was like, well, I'm going to get up and I'm going to work on an assignment. And I thought Lucas was asleep because we'd been in bed for like a long time. So I get up and I'm being really quiet and I put my glasses on and I grab my laptop. And as I'm walking out, he was like, hey, where are you going? And I truly almost lost control of all my bodily functions.
Mm-hmm.
And that was with a person that I knew was in the room, but just thought was asleep. So to wake up somebody standing over you,
yeah,
is terrifying. Has your kid ever done that to you?
Oh yeah, she's done that already,
and it is like the scariest thing,
yeah,
ever.
Yeah. So okay, so Samantha's like, it's this guy Harkin, right? And so officers are like, that's weird. Mm-hmm. So a couple hours go by. They go over to the residence next door where Harkin lived. Mm-hmm. And they question him and his two roommates about the murders that had taken place. Harkin and his two roommates said they knew nothing about the murders and denied any and all involvement. But weirdly, later that day, Harkin ended up voluntarily going to the police station to speak with investigators.
Mm-hmm.
He shared that, and this is going to sound weird, just let me get through it. He shared that his friends were suspicious of his involvement, not his roommates. Other friends were suspicious in his involvement and said that he needed to talk to police and clear his name and provide them with whatever information he had. So he did that. When officers asked why he had not been forthcoming earlier in that day when they talked to him, Harkin told them that he was fearful of being deported because he was an undocumented Honduran immigrant.
Mm, I think that's fair.
And he had entered illegally into the United States because he was fleeing from his hometown of Honduras when narcotics traffickers and gangs were trying to force him into their gang. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he ended up leaving to try to take care of his family. So he came to the States. He literally swam for most of it, a lot of time.
Wow.
So they asked him to provide his account of the night of the murders. And so Harkin shared with investigators that he had been heavily drinking, partying with his friends the day and evening before because he had the day off from work. Okay. So he started day drinking, drank until early hours of the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So around 5 o'clock that morning, he had run out of beer. The liquor store would not open for another couple of hours. And so he said that around 6 a.m., he went next door to ask the women if they had any beer because he'd done that many times before. According to his initial statements, he said that when he walked over to the house, he went to the front door and it was never locked and it was slightly open. So he said that when he walked in, that's where he found Cheryl on the floor in front of the door.
Okay.
He said that's when he found Cheryl on the floor. And when he saw her, he lifted her body into his lap and tried to revive her, but realized she was dead. Panicked, he went into the living room and found Grandma Carol's body, and she too was dead. Harkin said that's when he saw a knife near Cheryl's body, and because he feared that the killer was still inside the house, he picked it up and screamed, "Is anybody here?" When there was no reply, he went to Samantha's room. He told investigators that Samantha was not there. She wasn't in her room, but it looked like her room had been ransacked. So realizing the gravity of the situation, Harkin said he ran home, tossed the knife into the grass along the way. He stripped off his clothes because they had blood all over them, put them in a plastic bag, and then washed himself.
Okay.
When asked why he would take the murder weapon with him and discard of his clothes before calling the police, Harkin simply said he didn't know what to do and sucked the story that he was afraid of being deported. He shared that when he saw some friends later that day, like I said before, told him what happened, they encouraged him to go to the police and tell them the truth. So he shares this information. Officers immediately arrest him for tampering with evidence.
Okay.
So they're like, this is weird. This is a weird story. And because he admitted to taking the knife, we're going to arrest him for tampering with evidence. So at least we can hold him. So we can follow this lead, right?
Sure.
So there were doubts, obviously, about him telling the truth and what happened. The bloody knife found between Carol and Cheryl's house and the residence where Harkin lived was a large kitchen knife, as I had said. It resembled the knives used at the restaurant where Harkin worked. Investigators followed up with the employees at Harkin's restaurant and were told by the head chef that one of the restaurant's 10-inch chef knives were missing.
So this is really not looking good for this guy.
Right.
And it gets worse. This is not looking good.
It gets worse. Based off of information that they gave, that Harkin gave them, along with a search warrant, they went over to his house and they found a plastic bag on the roof of his shed in the backyard filled with bloody clothes. Okay.
Right.
So he technically lived in this little shed in the back of the house, and the two roommates lived in the mobile home.
Yeah.
So he didn't have like running water. He didn't have like a bathroom. It was, I mean, he was just living in base shelter over his head kind of stuff.
Okay. So
they retrieved this plastic bag filled with underwear, socks, t-shirts, shorts that were all covered in blood.
But I mean, he told them that he took his clothes off, that he had checked the victims and they were bloodied. So I mean, that's not super weird at this point.
Yeah. They also recovered his shoes that had blood on the soles of them.
Again, not weird.
Saying that he put himself in the crime scene. When investigators confronted Harkin about the overwhelming evidence, he was adamant that he had nothing to do with the murders, that he had found the two women like that and then left again due to his fear of deportation. Okay? That's the story. He's sticking to it.
Right.
So the circumstantial evidence is mounting. And so just a week after being arrested for tampering with evidence, on June 25th, 2004, Clemente Aguirre Harkin was formally charged with the murder of Carol Baris and Cheryl Williams. He was taken to jail, where he would spend the next roughly year and a half awaiting his trial.
Hmm.
Now, I am not a legal person. Legal jargon definitely goes over my head a little bit. And I was elbows deep in case files and the trial transcripts. And I'm just doing my best to summarize all of that.
Mm-hmm.
This could have easily turned into a really, really long case. It's already going to be long as it is, but I will try to keep it short and to the point.
Okay.
There's a lot of reports that during this year and a half that he's being held, there were lots of motions and complaints during this process by Harkin. These complaints and motions ranged from him not being provided with adequate legal representation, not having all of the documents provided to him in Spanish because he did not speak very good English.
Right, right.
And his main complaint was that his attorney in the beginning, his assigned attorney, shared that they thought he would lose the case. Multiple times, Harkin tried to petition to represent himself. He was pissed with the legal representation, but the judge presiding over these hearings encouraged him not to represent himself.
Right.
So Harkin reluctantly agreed to stick with his public defenders.
Mm-hmm.
He had requested a speedy trial, but that was too discouraged by the legal counsel due to it being a capital case. Because in August of the year of the murders, the state filed a notice of intent to seek the death penalty. So now this is a capital case. And so you have to be very careful, and they're very, very lengthy.
Oh, goodness.
So finally, in February of 2006, so this is right under 2 years after the murders, the trial began in Seminole County Circuit Court for the murder of Carol Baris and Cheryl Williams.
Mm-hmm.
During the course of the trial, various law enforcement personnel, physicians, experts, witnesses, all testified to the evidence at the crime scene as well as to the victim's wounds. According to Dr. Beaver, who was the medical examiner for both women, Grandma Carol died from a stab wound to the heart. He testified that it would have resulted in an instantaneous drop in blood pressure, which would have caused her to lose consciousness in less than 20 seconds. He said that she was likely in the wheelchair when she was stabbed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it would have caused her to go unconscious. She would have fell face first. And that explains, in his opinion, why she was found face down on the floor. And it also explained the abrasions found on her face.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense to me.
And he also said that the stab wounds were consistent with being caused by the chef's knife that was found between the victim's residence and Harkin's home.
Okay.
The blood on the knife. So the knife was tested. The DNA on the knife was tested. And both Grandma Carol and Mama Cheryl's blood was found on the knife.
Okay. So one weapon for both
murders.
Mm-hmm.
Mama Cheryl's blood was on the handle, and Grandma Carol's blood was found on the blade, which indicated that Mama Cheryl was likely killed first.
Okay.
Another expert witness was a crime scene analyst who was brought in to testify regarding the blood splatter evidence found at the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
This analyst shared with the court that there were 67 bloody shoe impressions found inside the victim's residence. And to get more specific, so of those 67 shoe impressions, only 8 of them were of value for comparison. 4 of those 8 were consistent with Harkin's shoes. 3 were consistent with shoes of law enforcement officers who responded to the residence.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 of them did not match either Harkin's or law enforcement officers. So there's 1 footprint, shoe print, I should say, that doesn't match the suspect or law enforcement officials.
Okay. Well, that could have been Samantha's boyfriend.
Maybe.
Because he said he went in and checked her and she was cold, so he went back out. I mean.
Mm-hmm. DNA analysis confirmed that the soles of the shoes, of Harkin's shoes, contained Mama Cheryl's blood.
But but again, he said that he walked through the house like, hey, is anybody there? Checked in Samantha's room.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, he's confessing to, yeah, I was there and blood was there. Blood was everywhere. I walked through the house. I checked the house.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like this is damning evidence at this point.
Yeah. And so a Florida Department of Law Enforcement bloodstain pattern analyst also examined the bloody clothing found in the plastic bag. Evidence was shared with the court that Harkin's shorts had bloodstains on the front and back. This FDLE bloodstain pattern analyst testified that the contact stains on the back of his shorts were not contact stains, but had gotten there by some type of motion, whether it was splatter or cast off.
Okay. Yeah.
And further, Harkin's socks had contact stains as well, and the spots that were, quote, consistent with dropped blood. So they're saying it doesn't look like it was smudged or pushed into a pool of blood. It looked like drops.
Drops of blood.
Mm-hmm.
Man, okay.
And now for the nail in the coffin for Harkin. This came from the testimony from a fingerprint examiner by the name of Donna Burke. Donna Burke testified that she had positively identified Harkin's palm print in the blood on the knife that was recovered at the crime scene.
We have palm prints?
Mm-hmm.
Well, crap.
We have footprints, too.
That makes sense, but yeah, I guess we would have palm prints. Just looking at my palm, seeing what my palm print would be. Checking my life and love line while I'm there as well.
Yeah. And also during the trial, a psychologist, Dr. Deborah, who had conducted a forensic evaluation of Harkin, she testified that she had interviewed him roughly 11 times. She also reviewed Harkin's statements to police, the witness statements, the police statements, reports, depositions, and reviewed the crime scene photos and video. She had told the court that Harkin had a tough childhood in Honduras, experiencing frequent physical and sexual abuse. She shared with the court that Harkin's test results indicated valid responses, but that he had an emotional functioning level consistent with an adolescent or teenager. She said he used
his emotional regulation was stunted type of thing, like impulse control, like that sort of stuff.
Just in general, his emotional functioning, he was like a teenager.
Okay. Now, is that connected to mental functioning as well? Do you know?
I don't know.
Does that make sense?
I think that they're separate. A lot of times there's a correlation, but I didn't see any specific reports about testing his IQ, but it was understood that he definitely probably wasn't the brightest bulb in the box.
Okay. So he essentially was a 20 some odd year old man, but emotionally he seemed to be more like a 14 year old type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. She said that he viewed the world immaturely and was guided by fun, pleasure, and excitement.
Gotcha.
Like a teenager does.
Okay, that makes sense.
And so Dr. this Dr. Deborah Day ended up diagnosing him with a mood disorder in addition to alcohol and cocaine use, or alcohol and cocaine abuse. And it had been identified throughout the trial that he started drinking, like his dad was an alcoholic. He started drinking when he was 14. He was probably an alcoholic.
Right.
And he started using cocaine pretty, like when he was like 18.
Okay.
So he was definitely a drug and alcohol abuser.
Okay.
There was also another psychologist who assessed him. So Dr. Reebsame interviewed Harkin as well and observed that he was prone to impulsive behavior without considering the consequences of his actions. He gave him assessments in which the scales for alcohol and drug use were elevated in all the tests, along with aggressive behaviors.
Okay.
Harkin denied in court as having any psychotic symptoms around the time of the murder. And he had told Reebsame that he drank all day and into the evening, and that he was also using cocaine. Dr. Reebsame testified that Harkin's capacity to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law was not substantially impaired. So he was not out of touch with reality, essentially.
I have personally not used alcohol and cocaine at the same time and then tried to function. But I would think that that combination, or any sort of combination with like substances, would cause some impairment. But okay.
And I think that's the point I'm trying to make here, is that you had two credentialed individuals give them a battery of assessments, and they both came up with some similar but some varying assessments from that.
Okay.
And so going back to this Dr. Reebsame, who had interviewed Harkin, he had testified that Harkin had shown throughout the evening and the murders self-control. So earlier in the night of the murders, Harkin was at a billiards club, a pool hall, until a police showed up because he had gotten into a fight. He and his friends returned to the friend's home, where they continued to drink until about 3 a.m. And he returned home around 5, as I said before. And so what I'm saying is, Dr. Reebsame was saying he obviously knew limits to his control, because he was able to manage getting in a fight with this guy. So he didn't completely go off the rails.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I mean, it does, but I'm having a hard time agreeing maybe with it, but
right.
Okay.
So Harkin ended up taking the stand in trial himself. And so he began to testify about his version of events.
Mm-hmm.
And what he shared with the court was very similar to what he shared with investigators early on in the process. He shared that after he had been drinking all night, he wanted more beer. So around 6 a.m., he went over to the Williams' household. He pushed on the door, which was blocked by Mama Cheryl's body.
Mm-hmm.
And he noted that there was, quote, blood everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
After he got through the door, he touched Cheryl's neck, but he couldn't touch her right as she was face down. He lifted her and put his hand on her neck and asked her to wake up around 3 times. He put her over his legs as he told her to wake up. He shared that he was nervous because there was blood everywhere and he noticed things in the house were in disarray. He testified that that's when he saw the kitchen knife sitting on a box. He entered the living room and saw Grandma Carol lying near her wheelchair, and then he touched her, but she was not breathing. He said that he returned to Mama Cheryl, picked up the knife and screamed, "Is anybody here?" When nobody answered, he went into Samantha's room, saw that it had been destroyed. He left the house, tossed the knife, not knowing where it landed, and went home, as we had kind of said before.
Mm-hmm.
And so throughout this trial, the defense made some pretty good points, Chelsea, and they were kind of a lot like what you said earlier. They were like, of course his footprints would be in the house. He admitted that he was in the house and that he walked around, right? Of course he would have blood on his shorts, his shirt, his socks, his shoes, because he admitted to both being in the house and checking on Grandma Carol and Mama Cheryl, right?
Right, right.
But despite all of this, the jury remained unconvinced of his story. And so on February 28th, 2006, a jury convicted Clemente Arguera Harkin of first-degree murder and burglary. They committed him of burglary for breaking into the house, essentially, and taking the murder weapon. So at the conclusion of the punishment deliberation, the jury voted 7-5 to impose the death penalty for the murder of Mama Cheryl, and 9-3 to impose the death penalty for the murder of Grandma Carol.
Right.
The trial judge then sentenced Harkin to death.
Oh, gosh.
In response to this, Harkin at one point rose from his seat in court and yelled, "They're trying to kill me for no reason. I didn't do it. I didn't kill nobody." But the jury had spoken, and Harkin was sentenced to death for both the murder of Carol Burris and Cheryl Williams, and was swiftly taken to serve out the remainder of his life on death row. So far, what are you thinking?
I have so many thoughts. I have so many thoughts right now. Because my first thought is like, I wouldn't do all of that stuff. Like, that was dumb. Like, why is he doing all of that? But then I also have a background in, you know, like, I'm CPR certified. I have multiple, I don't know, what am I trying to say? Like, I have extensive knowledge on infection control and how to regulate emotions during crisis. Like, I've been trained how to do this stuff, right? And so that leads me to the thought of, yeah, but how many people have that type of education? Not very many people have that type of education. Not very many people have that background. I also don't have extenuating circumstances, meaning like I am a citizen of the country that I live in, and I don't have any fear of deportation. I have a lot of things that this other person doesn't have. But ultimately, I'm just like, just because he was drinking and just because he had blood on him doesn't mean that he killed anybody. Like, there's reasonable doubt for me listening to this. I would not be able to, if we concluded that reasonable doubt means what, 95% with 95% certainty is what you looked up and gave us stats a couple weeks ago. I have more doubt than that on this situation.
Okay.
And even like with a palm print, like, okay, yeah, you pick up a knife if you think that there's somebody in the house. I mean, again, all of this does seem plausible. Would I have done it? I don't think I would do it, but I also think I understand that
You also weren't drunk and high on cocaine.
That's exactly it. Like, I can also recognize that I'm bringing a very calm, rational, quote unquote, educated, meaning like education within things of that nature.
Right.
Perspective to this. And that shouldn't really be projected upon. Like, we shouldn't project that on somebody who wasn't in that mindset.
Right.
I don't know.
No. There's a lot with this. This was a pretty intense case with lots of like forensic evidence, this, that, and the other, right?
For sure.
And so, as expected, after his conviction, Harkin fought relentlessly claiming that he was innocent.
Yeah.
You know, and to be fair, half of me is like, they always think that they're innocent or claim that they're innocent.
I was just about to say, the other half of me is working with middle schoolers, since we are saying that he might have had more of a middle school. I have literally watched kids do stuff, and they will be in my face saying, you know, I didn't do it. I didn't, like, they would they would die on that hill of I didn't do it. And I can't really tell you why they deny it so fervently.
Right.
I mean, I've seen it and I'm just like, dude, I literally watched you do that. And they're like, I didn't do it. I didn't do it, Miss Chelsea. I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I also have seen that side of things where they just flat out lie.
Yeah. And so what's interesting here, though, is it didn't take long before cracks began to appear in the state's evidence against Harkin. So the prosecution, essentially.
Okay.
One thing that they found early on was that back in April of 2007, just a year after his conviction, the Office of the State Attorney filed notice that the Seminole County Sheriff's Office had received a complaint about the quality of Donna Burke's work in the latent print section.
And Donna Burke was the psychologist? Oh, the DNA fingerprint.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
She was the print examiner, if you will, the okay. analyst with the prints.
Okay.
According to the FSU Library, Law Library, on May 4th, 2007, the Office of the State Attorney sent an email to a man named Tim Cottle, who was the assistant public defender in Harkin's trial. And this email said that the FDLE did not agree that the latent print on the knife was of sufficient value to identify Harkin as the person who in fact touched it.
Mm.
So where did this complaint come from? Well, at some point in 2007, Donna Burke's work came under review. Her work came under review after a coworker by the name of Christina Barber. She was a crime lab analyst with the FDLE.
Mm-hmm.
She was assigned to the latent prints department. And it was reported that she was asked to examine the evidence in this case.
Mm-hmm.
She re-examined the latent print on the knife and compared it to the known standard of Harkin and said that the print was not of value for identification.
Really? Meaning the print wasn't a good enough print to positively identify?
She couldn't say either way.
Okay. There just wasn't enough evidence.
It wasn't a good enough print to use as a comparison.
Gotcha.
She even had four senior crime lab analysts, two regular crime lab analysts, and a crime lab supervisor verify her results, and they all agreed that this print was not able to be compared.
Oh, yikes.
They determined that Donna Burks, in fact, made an incorrect identification regarding Harkin's print on that knife.
Oh.
So as I said before, it was reviewed and it was not suitable for comparison. Now, based on this new evidence, Harkin and his legal team filed for a motion for a new trial based on this new disclosure,
uh-huh.
right?
Yes.
So his legal team is like, hey, we have this report that this fingerprint examiner couldn't have possibly identified Harkin as the guy holding this knife.
Right. Yeah.
But in 2009, it was denied.
Why?
The judge argued that even if this was presented at the original trial, the jury likely still wouldn't have voted for an acquittal.
Oh, man. See, I have a hard time with that. I have a hard time with that because I don't feel like that's fair to say what somebody would or would not, what something would or would not persuade another person.
And the judge, yeah. And so part of me understands this from the judge. The judge is saying it doesn't really matter because Harkin reported grabbing the knife anyways. So it doesn't really matter if there's a handprint match or not because he already admitted to holding the knife.
Okay. I can see that. Yes.
But I think on your side of the fence, from an emotional perspective from the jury, I think that hearing a fingerprint expert saying, you know, I identified that his print in the blood of the knife, I think emotionally that charges them.
Absolutely. A thousand percent. I mean, when you tell me stories and you're like, and there was fingerprint evidence, in my mind, I'm like, ooh, well, that shuts that down. Like instantaneously,
when you hear DNA, when you hear fingerprints.
Yes.
You don't question that.
I really don't. I stick a pin in that because I'm like, oh, well, there's fingerprints and fingerprints don't lie.
Yeah.
Like I don't question that. That is something I would naturally do if you were to tell me that there was fingerprint or DNA evidence in somewhere. I would be like, oh, well, I guess I was wrong.
So even though Harkin's legal team found that this so-called nail in the coffin was falsely identified by a prints expert, the court still declined it. The Supreme Court upheld his convictions and the death sentence.
Mm.
Okay.
Okay.
But luckily for Harkin, in 2011, his attorneys asked for the help from the Innocence Project in seeking DNA testing on more than 80 pieces of evidence that had not been tested.
Why have I heard the Innocence Project?
We've talked about it a lot, but the Innocence Project is a nationwide nonprofit that helps address the DNA case. Like Carl Drew is working with the Innocence Project right now.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And Dr. K references them as well. Uh-huh. Is that right?
And Dr. A, I think.
That's right. Okay. Yes, 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 yes. Yeah.
So now the Innocence Project has gotten involved. They've taken on his case, and it was a massive undertaking. Harkin's support now consisted of the efforts of a mega defense team comprised of 8 lawyers, including post-conviction attorneys Marie Palmer and Maria DeLiberato, mm-hmm. and Innocence Project lawyers Josh Dubin and Nina Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
And so 2 years of the Innocence Project helping in Harkin's case and the testing of DNA evidence collected at the crime scene, the results of the tests were in, and they were going to be presented at an evidentiary hearing in 2013.
Okay.
Now, drum roll, what did the results say?
That he didn't do it.
The new DNA evidence tested from the crime scene found that Harkin was excluded as the source of DNA at the scene. Of the 8 locations that blood was found that did not match Grandma Carol or Mama Cheryl, it did not match Harkin's. The blood found actually matched Samantha Williams' DNA.
Ooh. Dun, 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 dun.
So in addition to this, Harkin's legal team presented evidence that Samantha Williams had a violent temper and she had been treated for some significant mental health issues.
And she very conveniently said, I didn't do it, but guess who I think did do it?
I have a gut feeling that this homeboy did.
I have a gut feeling that this guy...
So she had been taken to the psych hospital roughly 60 times for psychiatric evaluations.
Did you say 60 as in
60
groups of 10?
Yes. Yeah. On one occasion, while being transported by police, she was recorded saying that her mother and grandmother had, quote, died for me. In this evidentiary hearing, Samantha testified that on the night before the murders, she had argued with her mom, but denied having any involvement in the crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Her then-boyfriend, Mark, his testimony had changed slightly from that of the original trial. So at the original trial in 2006, Mark, who was Samantha's boyfriend at the time of the murders, he testified that Samantha was with him all night and she couldn't have left to commit the murders, which is what formalized her alibi. However, at this new evidentiary hearing, Mark testified that although he and Samantha went to bed in his home the night of the murders, he was, quote, dead to the world and could not say that she didn't leave during the night.
I was just about to say, I thought my husband was asleep when I tiptoed out of there to do that assignment, and he sure wasn't. I was wrong. Scared the crap out of me, too. He didn't know he was sleeping.
And on top of all of this, a crime scene expert testified that what was said, that the blood spatter on Harkin's clothing was actually blood that had transferred when he picked up the victims.
Mm-hmm.
So even though initially they said some of this is splatter, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, some of it was contact.
Mm-hmm. This blood splatter expert said it was transferred when he picked up the victims. Regardless, it gave reasonable doubt that the blood on his clothes were actually from cast-off, meaning it wasn't necessarily proving that he was the one doing the stabbing. It was just consistent with his story that he was touching the victims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, are you ready for this?
Oh, I'm ready for it.
While the appeal of the denial of the motion for a new trial was pending, the case was remanded to allow the defense lawyers to present additional evidence that Samantha had confessed. All according to Maurice Possley's article, 4 different people testified that Samantha had admitted she killed her mother and grandmother. Samantha's friend Nicole Casey testified that on 2 occasions in 2010, Samantha admitted to the murders. Casey also said that Samantha was crying and making, quote, a stabbing motion towards her chest. Casey said Samantha had told her, quote, that the demons had made her do it.
Oh.
3 of Samantha's former neighbors testified to 3 separate instances in which Samantha admitted to the murders. So one of them was a neighbor at a neighborhood barbecue. Samantha was like, I'm crazy, I'm evil, I killed my grandmother, I killed my mom.
Oh.
Other neighbors were like, they had asked her to leave their property. She was like, I'm not afraid of you, I killed my mom and grandma.
All right.
So are you ready for this?
If it's bad, then I'm not ready for it.
Despite this new evidence, Circuit Judge Jessica Rexedler denied the motion for a new trial.
How is that possible?
She ruled that the evidence would not have convinced a jury to acquit Harkin.
It would have convinced me. Let me on that jury.
So
let me be juror number 8. Like, come on. Are you kidding me right now?
Not kidding you right now.
She said, A.S.S. said that she did it. But I guess that's circumstantial, right?
I don't know, man. I don't know.
If you tell me that this dude was killed on the debt, like if he actually was killed, I'm done. I'm going home. I'm going to take my ball and go home. So tread lightly, Bailey. Tread lightly.
So Harkin's legal team, feeling that Judge Rex Edler was incorrect in her ruling, appealed to the Florida Supreme Court. In October of 2016, the Florida Supreme Court reversed the denial of a new trial, vacated Harkin's convictions and death sentence, and ordered a new trial. So they went above her head and they were just like, this
no,
judge,
ma'am.
Uh-uh.
No, ma'am.
And the Supreme Court was like, all right, you get a new trial.
Okay. Oh. Whew.
The court ruled that adding the newly discovered evidence to the picture changes the focus entirely.
Mm-hmm.
No longer is Harkin this creepy dude who shows up in Samantha's room in the middle of the night. He is now a scapegoat for her crimes. And when the DNA evidence is considered together with Samantha's numerous unequivocal confessions, the result is reasonable doubt as to Harkin's culpability.
Mm, very nice.
So fast forward 2 more years. Now, I want y'all to understand that this dude is sitting on death row.
Mm-hmm.
2 more years after the Supreme Court overrules the denial and they mm-hmm. allow a new trial, we're now in March of 2018. During jury selection for a retrial, Judge Rex Edler, remember the one who initially said, she declared a mistrial after jurors were heard talking about searching the internet for information about the case. So they're starting to get jury selection for this retrial. She says it's a mistrial because jury members are doing something they're not supposed to be doing. Not long after that, however, Judge Rex Edler agreed to remove herself from the case. The defense had alleged that she had a personal stake in obtaining a second conviction for Harkin to show that her decision not to grant the new trial was correct.
Oh.
So she essentially stepped down. The defense argued that Judge Rex Edler had tried to leverage this case for her own gain by touting her denial of post-conviction relief and her application for a position on the District Court of Appeal, even while the appeal of that decision remained pending before the Florida Supreme Court. So they're saying she wanted to go for the District Court of Appeal. She wanted to work for a higher court.
Mm-hmm.
And so it didn't look good if she overturned something she shouldn't have, or she denied something she shouldn't have denied.
Right. She's trying to save face.
Right. So after the mistrial, due to the issues with the jury the first go around, jury selection began in October of 2018 for a second time. With the new evidence found, with the work of Harkin's legal team to include the Innocence Project, they were working hard to prove Harkin's innocence. Seminole County techs took samples but never bothered to test them, according to a statement from Grant and Eisenhofer, who was Harkin's legal, they were his attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So part of their argument in this new trial is these people took samples but didn't even test them. They added that authorities neglected to take into account Samantha's propensity for violence and threats against her family. Harkin's, now get this, strong alibi for the time of the murders was also never properly investigated. So Harkin's legal defense team were able to prove that he had an alibi and there were multiple witnesses and records of it. He was at a local pool hall at the time when investigators determined the time of death. On top of that, during this time, the defense dropped a bombshell. They revealed a sworn affidavit from Mark Van Sant, remember Samantha's then boyfriend, his new wife, Nicole Bozegard, that contradicted his original testimony. In this affidavit, Nicole said about her husband that he had told her that Samantha woke him during the night and said that she had, quote, a bad feeling about her mother. He had offered to drive her home. She declined, said she'd get a taxi, and would be home in the morning to pick up a load of laundry.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if all of that evidence is in that same box where they're keeping Carl Drew's evidence.
Yeah, where they kept his alibi.
Right, where all of his alibis and affidavits are. I wonder if it's in that same box.
Well, this is a different box because they found this one and they're using this one.
Well, good.
Yeah. But Nicole, Mark's wife, had in her affidavit, she said that that Mark had told her that Samantha left on the night of the murders by crawling out of his bedroom window.
What?
Yeah, that she left that night.
She crawled out of the window?
Yeah. That's what the affidavit said.
All right.
Okay. In a wild turn of events, just a few weeks after this, on November 5th, 2018, with jury selection still in progress, the prosecution all of a sudden dismissed the charges against Harkin.
You can do that?
I guess so. Seminole County State's Attorney Phil Archer issued a statement that the decision was, quote, based upon new evidence that materially affects the credibility of a critical state witness. So he's essentially saying, like, all of the holes in our state witness of Samantha is being, like, ripped apart. So in a nutshell, after the Innocence Project got involved, there was now new DNA evidence, discovered confessions, and DNA evidence that pointed to the prosecution's chief witness as the actual killer. So how can the prosecution proceed with that?
Right.
After an exoneration hearing in November of 2018, Clemente Aguirre Harkin walked out of a Seminole County courtroom, making him the 164th wrongfully convicted death row prisoner to be exonerated in the United States and 28th in Florida since 1973.
Wow.
He had served 14 years in prison, almost 15, 11 years on death row in Florida. Initially, after his release, he was released to the Department of Homeland Security for an immigration hold, and his attorneys had to file for asylum for him. And in January of 2019, his lawyers filed a petition in Seminole County asking a judge to declare him a wrongfully convicted person, a step in the process to seek compensation from the state of Florida. This complaint included specific sheriff's office personnel, which included the lead investigator on the case and crime scene technicians who worked on the case. The argument? When the sheriff's office investigators interviewed Harkin, who speaks limited English, they did not provide a translator to him.
Mm-hmm.
And again, according to an article by Emily Speck, Harkin's lawyer stated, were it not for the flagrant misconduct of the defendants, it would never have happened.
Mm-hmm.
As a direct result of the defendant's deliberate, intentional, and or reckless failure to investigate and their concealment of exculpatory and impeachment information, Harkin's civil rights were violated and he was robbed of over 14 years of his life and freedom.
Man.
In May of 2019, a judge dismissed the petition for this compensation, saying it was filed too late. Attorneys said they would appeal. In January of 2020, his lawyers filed a federal civil rights lawsuit seeking damages for his wrongful conviction. About the same time, two state legislatures introduced a bill that would award Harkin $720,000 in state compensation, which is roughly $50,000 a year for each year he was incarcerated. Joshua Dubin, an Innocence Project attorney who worked on Harkin's case, said, "This special claims bill is a way to provide Harkin with the means with which to rebuild his life after having lost 14 precious years."
Hmm.
And so, for the finale, Clemente Aguirre Harkin is currently living in Tampa Bay, Florida, in the only subdivision in the country that houses exonerated individuals.
Hmm.
It's a place to try and help them reintegrate into society and give them a taste of normalcy.
Hmm.
They are provided with therapists and other representatives to help them move forward productively in life. Likely struggling with PTSD and the awful memories of the near 15 years of his life, Harkin is trying to move in a positive direction. The family members and loved ones of Carol Burris and Cheryl Williams still grieve about the losses of their loved ones today, many of them still believing that Harkin is guilty, and they're unable to swallow the possibility that Samantha could have been the one responsible for their murders. Regardless of this, this is a horrific case that shows how the lives of two people ended and one person ruined, with countless others affected. This is also a case that shows that there are human biases in forensic science, and as scary as it may seem, forensic science may not be as accurate as we'd like to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, what do you guys all think?
Oh, man. That's a whole lot.
That's a lot, right?
That's a whole lot. Yeah, I would love I don't know. I would love to have an open forum on this. However, I say that with hesitation because I can see a lot of very strong personal convictions because we're covering wrongful.
You're covering all the hot topic cases, right?
We're covering immigration. We're covering mental health. We're covering
a death penalty.
Death penalty. We're covering like him being awarded a lot of money for a wrongful conviction. We're covering drug and alcohol abuse. That's a lot.
Yeah, people are going to be pretty divided.
I was divided. I am sitting here. Like, literally, I feel like I have, like, the two characters on my shoulders where it's like, well, what about this? Well, but what about this? Well, but what about this?
And maybe the place where I want to land is not necessarily looking at those things, but really encouraging our listeners to think about how the forensic evidence in this case played out and how that ties into Dr. K's research that he does and his mission to try to rule out any sort of human biases that may exist in forensic evidence so this type of stuff doesn't happen.
Yes.
Regardless of whatever reason, regardless of whether you believe in, you know, people who are immigrants getting equal representation, whether you regardless of whether or not you believe in the death penalty, it doesn't, I don't care about the, I mean, I care, whatever.
Right.
I don't care about that. I just want to challenge people to think about if the forensics in this case was done differently or properly, or if it wasn't so, it looks like this. I mean, we're talking about, what if we had,
Again, the importance of checks and balances. I think at the end of the day, it really is the importance of checks and balances, because until it was challenged, it was essentially one person's quote unquote expertise, and I'm going to say quote unquote. I mean, she obviously was an expert in her field, but in this scenario, it was determined that she was incorrect, right? So again, the importance of checks and balances in systems.
Well, it's interesting, yes, because also on this note, I believe it's Dr. K in his interview, you guys will hear that part of human bias is sometimes the scientists, these forensic scientists, know too much about the investigation, and that can play into their own personal biases. I'm not saying that Miss Donna Burke had any. I mean, she has biases like all of us do. And we can't conclude for sure whether that played into it. But hypothetically speaking, whether it's Miss Donna or it's, you know, Shirley Temple, it doesn't matter. If they knew the details of this case that we're dealing with, let's say that they were against immigration, they were against drug users, they were against, you know, people feeding off of hard-earned American taxpayer money or whatever you want to say, then they're more likely to see a connection. They're more likely to see the prints align with what they want to see. And that's what Dr. K's, that's his work, is like, we can't have this.
Exactly.
We've got to figure out ways that we can, like you said, have checks and balances. So if you do have some biases, there are other things that can keep it from turning into, this is the nail in the coffin for a death penalty for somebody who might be innocent.
Correct. Yeah, because there is not a lot of having somebody sign off on your work, right? Like she doesn't then send it to some supervisor that has it signed off. Like if you are the supervisor, you know, and you're the one who's doing the work and presenting the material. You know, I've seen it in the education system. I've talked to, and that's kind of what I mean on having checks and balances in all systems. You know, I've talked with teachers who are like, I refuse to dig into the upcoming class and into the kids that are going to be coming into my classroom. I do not want to know. I don't want to know how they acted in sixth grade.
Yeah.
They're now in seventh grade. I want them to start with a fresh slate. I'm not going to say it's few and far between, but there are some teachers that I've talked to that are very adamant on this idea of, I don't want to create a bias in my mind on a kid before I even actually meet them.
Yeah.
And the reason, and the way that I do that is I don't allow myself to look into records and things like that, and then you have people on the other end of it who are like, I like to know because I feel like I can better represent or better help. So again, that's another hot topic of, is a bias a good thing or a bad thing? But I think, like you said, the bottom line is Dr. K does a fantastic job of giving you some really tasty food for thought.
Yeah.
He brought up ideas and concepts that I really had never been introduced to. And I feel like I'm a pretty well-versed person.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the aspects that he presented as far as unconscious bias, things like the checks and balances within the forensic science profession or field, y'all, it's pretty astounding what his research has proven.
Yeah, and so I think cases like this make you question, maybe not too much, but just enough, saying, ooh, is forensic science as accurate as we think it is? And this is a perfect case. When I was like, man, I got to find a case to match this. And I came across this and I was just like,
yep.
If I didn't know the outcome of this, right? If I had been reading the papers when this was happening,
mm-hmm.
and they're like, oh, all of these experts are saying that this is him and this is him. I mean, of course, people are going to be like, yeah, screw him.
Yep.
And, luckily we have open-minded people at the Innocence Project who says, well, let's just look. Let's just see what the forensic evidence says. Let's see if we have more forensic evidence or different forensic evidence or different DNA. And luckily, luckily for this guy, there's people here who dedicate their whole lives to false convictions.
Seriously. And I really hope that you guys get a deeper understanding of reasonable doubt, like Bailey and I have in this process. I feel like in our process of reviewing these cases and interviewing these people, it has really broadened our horizon or broadened our capacity of asking questions and reasonable doubt. Because I feel we both were, like you said, if I saw DNA evidence or forensics evidence, I'd be like, absolutely. But then learning about some of these cases, you're like, oh, maybe I should question that a little bit more.
Yeah.
So hopefully that will fuel your questioning fire to question and look mm-hmm. a little deeper into things.
And you guys be on the lookout for Friday's interview with Dr. K so you can hear about some of this craziness.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that was wild. I haven't been that emotionally tugged from one end to the other in a while. Like that was all over the place.
You are welcome.
You are welcome. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
I know it was confusing,
that was a fun. I was really glad that I was on the listening side of that one because that was really fun to listen to.
I wish I hadn't been on the researching side of it. I was like, this sucks and I don't want to do this, but I was already, knee deep. And I also just want to do a small disclaimer before we let you guys go that I wanted to include more about the victims, but I couldn't find a, what do they call, like at the funerals,
obituary?
They had an obituary, but it didn't give any information about them. I mean, his name is attached all over the case with this murder, and I could not find any more personal information than I did. So I, my heart goes out to the Williams families, everybody involved, and, that's the reason I didn't include more information.
And I guess I shouldn't ask this, but do we have any updates on Samantha? Is that...
Nobody has been tried. Nobody has been tried for their murders.
Okay,
gotcha. Including her.
Okay.
From what I've researched. So,
yeah.
Doesn't mean that I'm 100% correct, but from what I saw, there's been no charges.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So, as usual, thank you guys for hanging out with us through this wild and crazy ride.
Absolutely. And we will catch y'all on the flip side.
Bye, guys.
Hey, Wildside Tribe. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Wildside Podcast. Make sure to tune in on Wildside Wednesdays. New episodes will drop each Wednesday at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We would love to hear from you, so if you have a wild case recommendation, email us at wildsidepodcast@gmail.com. That's wildside with a C. Or share your thoughts in the comments below.
As always, if you haven't heard it today, you're loved, you're worthy, and you're valuable. And we'll catch you on
the flip side.